now includes only Iran, Sudan, and Syria. The trade embargo against Cuba still remains in effect. However, Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, introduced S-491, the Freedom to Export to Cuba Act of 2015, in February. The Senate Agriculture Committee plans to hold a hearing on lifting the trade embargo next Tuesday.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Tuesday, April 14th, 2015. Palestinian fighter dies of wounds sustained last summer and Israeli troops demolish homes in Jerusalem. These stories are more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian fighter of Al-Qassam Brigades, the arming of Hamas, died in Gaza on Tuesday after succumbing to wounds he sustained last summer. The fighter, 22 years of age, suffered various wounds, including a serious head injury by an Israeli missile during the Israeli onslaught on Gaza 8 months ago. He remained in critical condition since then until he died on Tuesday, medical sources reported. The Ministry of Health in Gaza said that around 2,140 Palestinians, including 577 children, were killed in the Israeli onslaught. Dozens of Palestinians died of their serious injuries in the months that followed the Israeli onslaught. Over 11,100 Palestinians, including 3,374 children, 2,088 women, and 410 elderly people, were injured in the attack. According to the United Nations, around 40,000 children from Gaza require essential physiological care due to the Israel's latest war on Gaza, in addition to its repeated and extensive aggression since 2006. Staying in Gaza, a Palestinian reporter working for the Palestine TV was stabbed to death on Tuesday at dawn near his home near the Al-Nasr neighborhood in Gaza City. The reporter, Kamal Muhammad Abu Nahal, 40 years of age, was stabbed with a sharp object 3 times to the neck, throat, and his lower back. According to family members, worshippers found Abu Nahal's body near his home following dawn prayers. The Palestinian Center for Development and Media, MEDA, strongly condemned the journalist's murder and demanded the authorities in Gaza to investigate the crime and apprehend the assailants. In the West Bank, Israeli soldiers demolished on Tuesday at dawn an under-construction 40-story residential building in Wadi al-Joz neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem. Troops, accompanied by employees of the Jerusalem City Council, invaded the neighborhood after surrounding it and demolished the building, then left, witnesses told local media. In addition, soldiers invaded Silwan town south of Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and kidnapped 3 young men and moved them to Al-Muskubiya interrogation detention facility. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, April 14th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badmoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Doug McVeigh and Cliff Verla. The producer is Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter, we're at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. The theme is Water Wars, with a look at the global campaign against the Nestle Corporation. Guests will include Matthew Bristow of BARC, who will discuss the Cascade Locks bottling proposal, and Bob Saunders of the Crunch Nestle Alliance in Sacramento. At 9 on We Speak with human rights lawyer Gabriela Rivera about the legacy of sexual violence in Guatemala and Mayan women's struggle for justice. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative radio news with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's the KBOO Food Show with Chris Siegel and Rachel Bennett. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And now, stay tuned for an exclusive interview with Christopher Gunness, the head of the United Nations Agency dealing with Palestinian refugees.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Palestinian refugee camp of Yarmouk in Syria remains under the control of the so-called Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known by its Arabic acronym Daesh, for the second straight week. Aid groups have been unable to gain access to the camp and are concerned that many of the 18,000 residents are without food or potable water. For more on the situation in the camp, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with the head of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, Chris Gunness.
We are joined on the line now by Chris Gunness, who is the head of the UN Refugee Works Agency, which is the agency that helps Palestinian refugees, both in the West Bank and Gaza and in other parts of the world. And I wonder if you could give us a brief update on what the situation is in Yarmouk refugee camp in Syria.
Well, good question. And just to point out to your listeners, Yarmouk is a refugee camp on the outskirts of Damascus, just about 10 kilometers from the city center. And about a week ago, just over, it was taken over, a large part of the camp was taken over, the majority of the camp was taken over, by ISIS, the Islamic State. And that, of course, produced intense fighting in the streets because you had groups, Palestinian groups in the camps resisting, and, of course, a lot of concern on the part of the Syrian authorities. Now, there's been intense street fighting since this move in by ISIS. The civilians, 18,000 civilians, of whom 3,500 are children, are caught up in the middle of all this. So we are extremely concerned about the protection of civilians. The Commissioner General of UNRWA, who is effectively the Executive Director of UNRWA, has just been in Damascus on a mission. He had meetings with the Syrian government at which he impressed on them the need to have humanitarian access to civilians in the camp and for those who wish temporarily to be evacuated, also to be given life-saving services by UNRWA. The great concern now, of course, is that the fighting continues and civilians are left really fending for themselves. People are too frightened to go out from their battered homes. They're holed up as the war rages outside. And there's been no UN food, medicine or water since the 28th of March. So there really is a serious humanitarian situation evolving, which is massively complicated by the intensification of the fighting.
Now, even before the invasion of ISIS into the camp, the situation in Yarmouk was not good. Can you talk about what things were like before the ISIS takeover last week?
Well, already the camp of Yarmouk had been under siege. What happened was armed groups moved in at the end of 2011, and the government responded by besieging the camp. And just last year, we had only 131 days of humanitarian access, and we were able to deliver really not enough food. On average, we estimate that the average person in Yarmouk was surviving on 400 calories a day, which is absolutely nothing. This was a community in which women were dying of childbirth for lack of medicines, and children were dying of malnutrition. So it was already an absolutely appalling place. And then, as we said, 10 days ago, we had the infiltration into the camp of ISIS and a sharp intensification of fighting.
Now, many people in the West and probably in our listening audience are pretty overwhelmed by the situation in Syria and looking at the complication and the fact that U.S. arms that were meant for moderates ended up in the hands of the more extreme groups and the many groups that are operating in Syria. Do you see a negotiated settlement as a way forward in the resolution of the civil war in Syria?
Well, as far as UNRWA is concerned and the United Nations is concerned, there can be no military victory in Syria. It's very hard, if you talk to military people, if you talk to strategists, to see and to try and understand what a military victory would look like. So at some stage, and who knows when that will be, there will have to be a political resolution, and that will involve talks. It will involve the parties sitting down. It could involve anything, but we're so far away from that, it's very difficult at this stage to see what the contours of a political resolution would look like.
What about a temporary ceasefire? Is that a near possibility?
Well, temporary and probably localized. I mean, we've been calling for a temporary ceasefire in Yarmouk, and I think it's perfectly possible to have that. We have had humanitarian access. It's been shown that the parties in the camp can at least lay down their arms for a long enough period for UNRWA to move in and to start distributing aid. And our view is that if you can do it for a period in which we can distribute aid, then you can do it for a longer period. So let's hope that given the mission of our Commissioner General, who's just been in Damascus and spoken to all the parties, it will now be possible for us to start securing humanitarian access to the camp. That's certainly the view of the United Nations. And, you know, we will not give in to the Council of Despair and Optimism. We will not abandon hope, because to abandon hope would be to abandon the people of Yarmouk, and we will not do that.
For the Syrian government to assist in getting aid to the refugees in Yarmouk, will they need to battle ISIS, or has ISIS agreed to allow humanitarian aid to enter?
It's unclear at the moment exactly what the position on these questions are. We had very good meetings with the Syrian government, and they're very supportive of our attempt to get humanitarian aid in. They realize, I think, the importance of protecting civilians. Through the UN's political office, we're having indirect and discreet contacts with the armed groups inside the camp. I think it'll take a little more time to clarify the situation, but certainly we're hopeful that in the coming days there might be news that we will be able to get aid into the camp to people who need it. In the meantime, we are broadening our humanitarian response, and we're dealing with people who fled into neighboring districts, some 3,000 who need urgent help also.
And what does it mean that ISIS has captured this camp, which is so close to Damascus? Does it appear that ISIS is close to actually besieging the capital?
I don't think anyone is seriously saying that. I think that, first of all, Yarmouk, if you control Yarmouk, you control the southern approaches to Damascus. So in that sense, it's strategically important. And as you say, it's a matter of kilometers from the administrative heart of Damascus. So from that point of view, it's very important and strategically important. But I don't think anyone is suggesting that ISIS are about to take over Damascus.
How widespread is the reach of the control of Daesh or ISIS in Syria right now?
Look, it's impossible to say, because we only work in the refugee camps, which are, there are 12 of them across Syria, and we just don't have a feel for that. I'm sorry, I can't really answer that question.
What about the international community's support? Have you Have you gotten enough support to be able to fund the needed humanitarian efforts for the refugees in Syria?
No, we've not. We have launched an appeal for $415 million, and only 20% of that is funded. Sorry, we desperately need the donor community to respond, because at the moment, we, as I say, only a fifth of our response is funded.
Has the United States participated in that donor effort?
Yes, very generously. The United States has given us $75 million, by far the biggest donor.
What is needed now for the refugees in Yarmouk? Is it the entry of humanitarian aid?
Yes, we need access, and for access we need security. Those are the two things. Security, people need to lay down their guns so that we can get in. It sounds unrealistic, but we are asking the international community to bring pressures on the parties to allow us into Yarmouk, because that is what we need in the immediate future.
I just want to ask you, since I have you on the line, as far as the situation in Gaza, the Palestinians that remain homeless from last summer's invasion by the Israeli military, how many people are still without homes there in Gaza?
We estimate that about 100,000 to 110,000 homes were damaged or completely destroyed. And if you assume between 6 and 8 people live in a house, that's between 600,000 and 800,000 people.
And how are people coping with the conditions there?
Very, very badly. I mean, the winter is slowly melting into spring, but we had a situation where over the winter period, children were dying of hypothermia. There were 4 children who died of hypothermia. There was flooding in Gaza. Things were absolutely terrible. But, you know, that now has gone. The problem in Gaza now is that we simply don't have the money for reconstruction. And, you know, $5.4 billion were pledged in the Cairo Reconstruction Conference in October last year. And because of a lack of funds,